Welcome in Zoom land and here in person. We're going to start the meeting of the Faculty Senate with the land acknowledgement. I'm Jonathan Oxhorn, Speaker of the Faculty Senate from the Department of Architecture. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayukono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayukono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayukono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayukono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Meeting is now in order. The first order of business is the approval of the minutes from February 9th, 2022. These have been posted and distributed online in the form of a verbatim transcript. Assuming there are no corrections, it will be approved through unanimous consent. I'll wait like 10 seconds to see if there are any corrections, but it's hard to understand how there could be in a verbatim transcript. I'm very pleased to announce our first speaker, who is new to Cornell, the General Counsel, Vice President Donica Thomas-Varner, who will visit the Senate virtually, I believe, and have a 10-minute presentation, after which we will have 15 minutes for Q&A. So, Donica, if you're able to unmute yourself and begin speaking, please do.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be able to meet you. Sorry that I wasn't able to join you in person. Not only was I a little confused about where I was going, but I actually have a meeting right after this by Zoom. So as mentioned, I'm Donica Thomas-Varner. I am the Vice President and General Counsel of Cornell University. I started here at the end of July. I've been practicing law for about 28 years. 22 of those years in higher education, both at large public research institutions, as well as a small selective liberal arts college. Prior to joining Cornell University, I was the Vice President, General Counsel, and Secretary of Oberlin College and Conservatory. Next slide, please. So I proposed this agenda for our conversation today so that we can get to know each other. I'd like to talk a little bit about my role as the Chief Legal Officer, speak a few minutes about shared governance, and then my role as a senior administrator. And I'm hoping that I will run through these slides quickly enough, but with enough substance that you will engage me in a really rigorous conversation in our remaining 15 minutes. Next slide, please. So, and next slide. As the general counsel, I wear basically three hats. I'm the chief legal officer for the university, and as you can see by this slide, my authority and responsibilities are outlined in the bylaws of Cornell University, Article 10. So I represent the university and those acting as agents or on behalf of the university within the scope of their employment. Our office manages all of the outside counsel that represent the university. The second of my three primary roles is dealing with governance, and so we're going to talk about that in a little bit. Providing legal advice to the Board of Trustees and the Board of Fellows. And then my last major bucket of responsibilities is as a member of the cabinet and providing executive leadership and support on a day-to-day basis and as well as long-term planning in order to help the institution achieve both its mission as well as its strategic initiatives. It's really important when talking about the role of the general counsel as the chief legal officer. I'd like to just be clear and reaffirm what many of us already know, that the general counsel and the general counsel staff represents the university as our primary client. I report both to the president and to the board of trustees. And as I mentioned previously, we're responsible for retaining all legal counsel to act on behalf of the university as well as its agents and employees. Next slide. So I don't do this by myself, obviously. We have a wonderful staff of legal professionals, including attorneys and paralegals, both here in Ithaca and also in our Weill Cornell Medicine legal office. There are 22 attorneys, 11 paralegals, and administrative staff. Those include the Office of the Secretary for the Board of Trustees that reports up directly to me, and the Office of the Secretary for the Weill Cornell Medicine Board of Fellows that reports to the Deputy General Counsel for Weill Cornell Medicine, Deborah Hodes. And I would imagine that during your course of employment, you may have had the opportunity to work with the attorneys and paralegals in their office. We are quite, I wouldn't say lucky, but we're definitely benefiting from a very high quality senior group of attorneys that do amazing work on behalf of the university. Next slide, please. So beginning in January of this year, we organized our work into basically four main subject matter practice groups. The Weill Cornell Medicine team will still provide their primary legal advice to Weill Cornell Medicine, but the attorneys in that office and the paralegals in their office are integrated with the Ithaca-based attorneys into these four groups: litigation, business, people, and research. And we have organized ourselves this way in order to be able to develop a teamed-based approach to respond to some of the university's most complex and challenging legal issues. And I could talk more about that during our Q&A if you want more information. But these practice groups will also be, next slide, please, focusing on outreach and training on their areas of expertise. Our office has legal expertise in a wide variety of legal areas, from administrative law to zoning, bankruptcy, employment benefits, academic HR. And as you can see on this chart, our litigation group, which is led by Val Crossdorn, is responsible for administrative agency proceedings, so complaints that we might get from the EEOC or the New York State Department of Civil Rights. They're responsible for advising on research misconduct issues and general compliance activities across the campus. Our research practice group is headed by attorney Rob Hume, and they include in their bucket of work technology transfer, academic innovation, intellectual property. This research technology and academic innovation group worked very closely with the research enterprises on both the Ithaca and Weill Cornell Medicine campuses. Our business, charitable giving, and transactions group is focused on contracts, endowments, gifts, estate planning, finance and debt management, real estate issues, and all of those practice areas and issues that have a transactional nature to them. And then we have our people practice group, and these are our legal experts who specialize in human resources related issues related to students, children and teens. You might hear people talk about minors or vulnerable populations on campus, immigration, emergency response, behavioral intervention, and threat assessment. Next slide. So here, just in case these names seem familiar with you, these are the attorneys on both campuses and how they are organized in their practice groups. And as you can see, many of them are in several different practice groups because they may have a primary specialty, but we're also interested in cross-training our attorneys so that there can be seamless service in all of these different areas. Next slide, please. So with this organization or reorganization, we now have these four practice group leaders. We will be coming to your academic units at the invitation of your deans to talk in more detail about how our work interfaces with the work of your schools and colleges. We are elevating our administrative staff, and so we have three new paralegals so that there's a paralegal that will support each of these practice groups. We are hiring a law fellow. This will be an ongoing one-year postgraduate position for new attorneys interested in higher education practice and who have a passion for creating diverse, equitable, and inclusive academic communities. So we're excited to be able to host our first law fellow beginning this fall. They will be with us 1 year with the option of staying a second year. And then we have an attorney who's linked to our Ithaca office, who's actually based in New York City. And so she'll be sitting at 570 Lexington several days of the week to provide support for your academic units that are based in New York City in addition to Cornell Tech. Next slide. So before I move on to the next section, oftentimes when I'm meeting with faculty and staff, one of the questions that I get is around the university's defense and indemnification policy. And this is rooted both in the bylaws and university policies. Defense means the university's commitment to representing employees and faculty when they're sued for activity arising out of the good faith performance of their authorized job duties. And indemnification means that if there is a judgment against you or a settlement, that the university will be responsible for settling that judgment or settlement. What's important to note in our policy here, policy 4.9, is that individuals who are sued must request representation, and we will confirm that the contours, the requirements for defense and indemnification are met. It requires that members who receive defense and indemnification fully cooperate with the defense, with the attorneys that we select in strategy. And in exchange for that cooperation, the university will fulfill its commitments by providing legal representation and cover any judgments or settlements. So next slide. So this is our mission for our office. We want to be a first-in-class in-house general practice law office that proactively advances the university's mission by providing timely and trusted legal services and by diligently protecting the university's resources. Next slide. So a little bit about my role in supporting shared governance. Next slide. So the legal authority for how responsibilities and authority is apportioned at the university sits here with these sources of authority. First, the charter that is now documented in New York Educational Laws Article 115 that creates the legal entity of Cornell University. We are also responsible for complying with the New York laws regarding nonprofit corporations, as well as federal IRS regulations as a nonprofit entity. Our accreditor, the Middle States Commission on Higher Education, Standard 7, has guidelines for the appropriate allocation of shared governance in this Standard 7, governance, leadership, and administration. And then all of that flows down and is reflected in our bylaws. And so all of our authority and responsibilities need to be in alignment with these legal authorities, beginning with the charter. our responsibilities for complying with our nonprofit corporation status, our responsibilities for complying with our creditors' expectations, and our bylaws. So all of our authority is delegated authority, and it's delegated consistent with these regulations and accreditation standards and our bylaws. Next. So I've had the pleasure of working for four higher education institutions, and governance is an important principle and that I take very seriously, and I take very seriously the role of the general counsel in facilitating effective shared governance. And in my mind, there are three big components to effective shared governance on any campus. And the first is our commitment to legal compliance. Understanding the authority of our delegated responsibilities is one step in that. Understanding our fiduciary responsibilities of the board and officers that they have to attest to annually when we file our IRS 990 form. We're responsible for complying with accreditation standards. We're also responsible through the board for making sure that we are maintaining the long-term health of the institution. Financial stewardship is something that's important for all stakeholders to be aware of and to take responsibility for. And this includes the impact of our decisions, including legal compliance on our insurability and credit rating. On the other end of this chart is our shared commitment to institutional stewardship. We are aligned, when we are aligned with our decision-making authority, with accountability and expertise, we are able to advance the institution's long-term interests in an appropriate way. So making sure that the people who have decision-making authority also are accountable for that authority is a really important and significant principle in terms of institutional stewardship. Everyone, I believe, is responsible for the ethical caretaking of the institution for future generations. And lastly, everyone sees themselves in positive relationship with the university and effective stewards for those areas over which they have responsibility. So when we have a commitment to legal compliance, a commitment to institutional stewardship, we've created the foundations for effective shared governance. And here in the middle, we're looking for clarity of roles and responsibilities. Again, alignment with those responsibilities with accountability and expertise. A regular review of our policies and procedures so that they're updated. Deep consultation and the provision of clarity around pathways for consultation. And regularized ways for clear pathways for effective communication, right? And what I love about these intersecting relationships, compliance, institutional stewardship, and effective shared governance, is that unlike our federal government and these checks and balances, we are all aligned with the core mission of the institution. And so rather than being adversarial in our model, we are cooperative and collaborative. Next slide. So here, and this, you know, these bubbles, these intersecting bubbles are primarily looking at the way the board, the faculty, and the administration intersect with the president at the center. And the president's cabinet with the general counsel is one of those people helping to make sure that those intersections are happening in thoughtful and collaborative ways. Staff, alumni, and students are also very important constituency groups that all of these key actors, what I would call the three legs of the stool, should be seeking to consult with. Students, alumni, and staff. The General Counsel works with the President and Cabinet to facilitate this dynamic and collaborative engagement. In terms of the main responsibilities of the board, there is a 1963 joint statement between AAUP, AGB, which is the American Governing Board, and ACE, around the governance of colleges and universities. And it talks about the fiduciary responsibilities for the operation of the university sitting with the board, the long-term stewardship of the mission of the institution sitting with the board, and it also outlines those main functions of the president and the administration to be accountable for the day-to-day management of the university, developing strategic priorities, policy development and implementation, and that the role of the faculty, as reflected in the university's bylaws, as being advisory. Under Article 13 in our bylaws, it talks about the faculty, the faculty leadership, having an important and critical role in considering and recommending educational policy of a general nature and recommending new degree programs, modification of degree programs, and discontinuation of degree programs. Next slide. So just really briefly, I'm trying to be thoughtful about my time so that we can engage. My role as a senior administrator. And so next, so really what I really want to do in my office is to be proactive, engaged, and strategic partners with you as faculty, with the cabinet, with the board to advance the university's mission. And our ability to do that requires that we're in regular conversation with you to imagine what the future of higher education is going to be, to understand your concerns, to find new pathways, and to affirm enduring values and principles. And those enduring principles, I would consider among the most important of those are our commitment to academic freedom, our commitment to freedom of inquiry, our commitment to tenure, our commitment to non-discrimination and anti-harassment, so that we can be a world-class academic center in which very vibrant, rigorous, scholarly work and research and artistic expression is happening across difference in a way that people feel a sense of belonging and thriving. Next slide. And so as we go out, as I go out to meet different members of the community, I'm asking these questions about what is the future of higher education? And as faculty, I would like to know, who will you imagine teaching in the future? Where will you be teaching? What will you be teaching? How will you be teaching it? And who will be your competitors? As we think about our responsibilities as institutional stewards, what does a Cornell education look like 10 years from now, 50 years from now? We should be engaging in these conversations. Next slide. What are the significant threats that will interfere with the university's success? Next slide. And what are the significant opportunities or areas for investment? And then the last slide, I think, is how can we in the Office of the General Counsel support you as faculty and faculty leaders as we navigate these really important questions about the future of higher education in general and our shared commitment to advancing Cornell's mission and making sure it's available for future generations of Cornelians. I think that's it.
Thank you. I think we only have a few more minutes for questions and answers. Please raise your digital hand if you are remote, or come to the front of the room if you're in person. We'll start with Zoom. I see Richard Bensel.
Thanks, Donica. When we were corresponding earlier this week, we were discussing the resolution for increasing the transparency and effectiveness of Faculty Senate proceedings. As you know, that was referred to your office by the Dean of Faculty 6 months ago for study. And when we corresponded, you said, or actually the Dean of Faculty said, there is no written report, that's a quote, and went on to say that the resolution has more to do with Section 2 of the Organization and Procedures of the University Faculty and less to do with the UFC or the Dean of Faculty positions embedded in the university bylaws. So I have several questions. One is, I have since had a chance to study the Organization and Procedures of the University Faculty. Is your office, the Office of General Counsel, mentioned in Section 2?
So the Office of the General Counsel provides legal advice to all of the entities within the institution. And so I've just had had the pleasure of digging into that particular section. I don't know the answer to your question off the top of my head, but I don't know if that's really an important, I don't know if that really helps us move a conversation forward, right? So I would ask all of you whether or not there's some written requirement that you all have access to the General Counsel's office when you are acting in your capacity on behalf of the institution. And my door is open to all of you to consult. And in fact, I get emails and calls from you all regularly.
Donica, this is an important question, but let me ask a broader one. Is your office mentioned anywhere in the Organization and Procedures of the University Faculty?
So if we go back to my slides, my office is mentioned in the bylaws. And as we look at the hierarchy of authority and delegated authority, my authority comes from the bylaws of the institution, which then sets the standards for anything that comes beyond that, such as rules or regulations that you as faculty in a department or as a group may decide to implement. It flows down. So anything that any individual faculty or staff member or administrator may want to implement has to be in compliance with not only the bylaws, but with accreditation, with our legal requirements, with our charter. So my authority as the General Counsel comes from the bylaws of Cornell University.
Thank you. As I understand it, and you, your presentation illustrated, you described, you provide legal counsel and representation for the central administration of Cornell University.
There's no one else.
Has your office taken a public position in opposition to that assumed ever taken a position in opposition to that taken by the central administration?
I don't think I really understand or can appreciate the question that you're asking, Richard. And I'd be happy to talk to you offline because I think that you may be digging at something that I'm not aware of. And so in light of the fact that this is an introductory conversation and I want to make sure other people have an opportunity to ask me questions, I invite you to schedule time with me and be happy to sit down with you. And I will say, the advice that I give, I'm by licensure required to give independent, thoughtful advice. And so that's what I do. And I give that to anyone who calls, as well as to the board and as to the cabinet. So I give legal advice. Not always people agree with my advice, but that is a healthy relationship that you would want your general counsel to be consulted with broadly, and you would want your general counsel to be independent minded and thoughtful.
Okay, we're a little bit over time now, Richard. There are three more hands up. I would like to steal some time from other agenda items, and if the questioners can go quickly and if the answerers can go quickly, starting with Michael Nussbaum.
Yes, Michael Nussbaum, Statistics and Data Science. So I'm a scientist, and sometimes I get a scientific paper for review, and usually the top journal gives me 5 weeks for a review. If I agree to write it and I don't send it in this period, then I get a reminder within a few weeks. Mm-hmm. Now, my question to you is, Did you ever get a reminder from the Senate leadership that this report is due because you were asked about a legal opinion for this particular resolution, and the resolution has not been on the agenda for 5 months? So apparently the legal opinion did not come forward within the 5 months. My question to you is, did you ever get a reminder similar to one which I would get for a referee report from the Senate leadership?
Yeah, no, it's really interesting that you would frame your professional interactions in the same way as legal interactions. We don't operate in the same way, but I will say Dean of Faculty DeRosa has been extremely communicative. I really do appreciate the grace that she extended me as a new general counsel here with some of the issues that I was facing in order to prioritize important issues. So I definitely feel very comfortable that the dean of the faculty was in regular communication. And I'm so thankful and appreciative of the grace that she extended me during my delayed response to this resolution.
All right.
Can we move on?
Delayed 5 months. And your office employs 22 attorneys. I just want everybody to remind that.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate that you're frustrated with the delay, and I accept that.
Laurent Dubreuil.
Laurent Dubreuil for Roman Studies. It's a simple question in a sense. So we don't have so many pages in the bylaws to define what are the roles and the functions of the university faculty, even though there is a long-standing practice and there have been in the past, even before my time here, agreements between the president's office and the university faculty to determine these shared governance. But at the very beginning of this year, we had a show from the provost's office trying to convince us that the little responsibility we as faculty had, as written in the bylaws, were in fact even smaller than what we thought we had. And so I would like to hear your opinion about these functions of the university faculty that, according to the bylaws, shall be to consider questions of educational policy which concern more than one college, school, or separate academic unit, or general in nature, and so on.
Yeah, Laurent?
Yes.
Yes, thank you so much. That's a great question, and that's a question that requires a longer a period of engagement.
I assume it is the case.
Yes, and so I tried to anticipate that you would have these concerns about my philosophy and how I think about that, so I tried to lead by sharing with that. Be happy at another time to come back and talk about that more specifically. So thanks for the invitation.
Thank you. Risa Liebowitz.
Thanks. I'll just be quick since we're running out of time. Thank you for coming to see us. My name is Risa Liebowitz, and I am faculty senator from the School of Industrial and Labor Relations. And I wanted to follow up on Laurent's focus on issues of governance and the bylaws, but also want to add to your reference to the AAUP joint statement on government with the other organizations that you identified. And I want to emphasize that there are certain areas, of course, in that statement that identify the primary responsibility of the faculty, including things like curriculum and faculty promotions issues and peer review, and that there are also areas for joint effort. And the statement emphasizes that unilateral decision-making is really a dysfunctional sort of approach. And so I think that as a new general counsel, I hope that it's the joint effort part that you can really work on so that we can actually improve relationships between the Senate and the administration. Because what we've been faced with over many years, and I'm sure you'll learn more about this over time, are unilateral decisions that are announced by the administration about moving forward on programs that are clearly educational policy rather than a true joint effort in decision making. And we'll be talking about one of those today on the part-time program issues. So thank you. I don't know if you want to respond to that, but I wanted to put that out there quickly.
No, I didn't hear a question. So I appreciate your perspective.
Okay, I don't see any more hands. Let's move on and try to make up the lost time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Senate announcements and updates from the Dean of Faculty, Eve DeRosa.
Hi, everyone. This will be a little bit like speed dating, I guess. I want to say that I received the resolution for increasing the effectiveness and transparency of the Faculty Senate before I had ever had a Faculty Senate meeting. And I want to say that the authorities embedded in the Dean of Faculty in terms of and the UFC in the bylaws has allowed for over 150 years for the UFC to function as it has. So I would like to know, and this is something when we bring this to this resolution to the Senate in April, why when it was Charlie and Joe and Bill as the Dean of Faculty that this resolution wasn't brought forward until now. Okay.
We have some time for Q&A.
I just want to say just very quickly, we have a need. We have teaching awards, the Stephen H. Weiss teaching awards, and we have not enough representation across the colleges and departments. I analyzed the data for 10 years, and the same, like an over-representation of particular colleges or one college is in the teaching awards and also particular departments within that college. So I made a pitch and a plea to the deans to give resources to under-resourced small departments that are not necessarily represented in the pool. And so feel free to self-nominate or nominate some colleagues that you know are excellent. And I want to also point to another issue that will be coming forward in the May Senate meeting is a student resolution that just passed asking faculty to record and record all of their lectures and make them available. So this is now sitting with the UFC, the EPC, and the AFPSF. And then I just want to show you everything that we're going to be discussing in April. We have a full Senate meeting already, and then we are bringing the resolution that's been the sort of the discussion already. And then Nima's going to just give you a brief overview of where we are on nominations and elections in response to the February request.
So just running you through a couple of sort of numbers things about how many of us work in the Senate and what we do. So the Senate consists of 129 senators. The bylaws ask that these senators be elected by their departments, which we hear is not happening across all departments. So do take that back to your chairs and departments and deans, that the bylaws actually ask that we elect our senators. Senators are elected for a 3-year term. And then, let's see, what else? So the entire university faculty elect certain positions. So they elect the dean of faculty, they elect the associate dean of faculty, 2 faculty trustees, 9 members of the university faculty committee, and 10 members of the nominations and elections committee. The entire university faculty, over 3,000 of us, also elect 9 senators at large. So that's the 22 elected positions we have in the Faculty Senate. Apart from that, the Dean of Faculty appoints members to a network of 12 committees. All this information is available on the Dean of Faculty website, right? And so what we do, when we count all those appointed positions, they include network of 12 committees. They include an advisory group and ad hoc committees, as and when issues come up for us to deliberate and think about. So there are actually currently 99 appointed positions. Next slide, please. So even I want to, and everybody else in the Dean of Faculty Office, Jill and CA as well, really want to thank those 129 senators, all of you in the audience here, and those of you who are up there in Zoom land, and the 22 members of the university faculty and the other 99 who serve in appointed positions. Without all your work, none of the shared governance piece of this university would occur. Thank you. Oh, wait, hang on. Now, the last piece that I really want to go into, which was asked of us last time. Next slide, please. Is how many open and, positions we have. So every year, the Associate Dean of Faculty, who chairs the Nominations and Elections Committee, is responsible to bring names to the Senate, to bring names to the Dean of Faculty, to begin to appoint everybody. So these are the appointed and the open positions we have. Of the open appointed positions, we have managed to fill everything but seven. We're having a really difficult time filling the elected positions. People do not want to stand for election. So one of the appeals that the Nominations and Elections Committee is making to all members of the university faculty is to request you to step up to serve in the Senate on behalf of your colleagues. So I'm going to end there. All this information, the slides, everything is available on the university on the DOF website. You can download it. Please take it back to your departments, take it back to your colleges, and request people to serve. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for Eve or Nima?
I think we should move on.
I don't see any questions, so we will move on since we are a little bit behind. We have a committee report, part-time bachelor's degree for non-traditional students from the Committee on Academic Freedom and the Professional Status of the Faculty. Ellen Gaynor, Performing and Media Arts, has 5 minutes, and then some time for discussion.
Thank you for... thank you. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you for providing us with the opportunity to present a summary of the Committee on Academic Freedom and the Professional Status of the Faculty's perspectives on the part-time degree proposal. Our committee chair, Professor Gillian Turgeon, couldn't be here today, and so I'm going to be here in her stead trying to summarize our report and address any questions that you might have. And you'll forgive me for reading, but wanted to make sure I'm covering everything thoroughly. So at the outset, I want to emphasize that our committee is completely in accord with our colleagues on the EPCC and on the EPC and CAPP on the desirability of offering a flexible undergraduate program that would enable non-traditional and underserved communities of students to pursue a Cornell degree. Like these colleagues, we see the potential program as being in keeping with Cornell's commitment to any person, any study. And also, like our colleagues, we feel strongly that any such program must protect and maintain Cornell's reputation for academic excellence. We focused our review of the draft program through a central element of our committee's area of charge. And I do want to read this so that everybody understands exactly what that focus is. And this is a quote from the charge. The professional status of the faculty, including but not limited to policies and procedures relating to faculty appointments, promotion, retirement, separation, tenure, and other related matters. So our report really poses questions and concerns that we believe are directly relevant to that clause of our charge. Our committee had a large number of questions and concerns about what the program could mean for faculty course loads and teaching-related responsibilities in the context of both the extant residential program and the new part-time program. We noted that faculty here are already operating at bandwidth limits for their teaching, research, extension service, and academic community service and responsibilities. We have many questions about course creation, content, and intellectual property, about the potential use of adjunct and/or increased graduate student labor, the implications for tenure and promotion criteria and assessment for those participating in this, and faculty compensation and potential financial inequities. We also raised concerns about the proposed program in the context of academic standards as they relate to faculty and departmental appointment processes and curricular oversight. We highlighted the potential for differences in academic standards and requirements between the residential and part-time degrees, noting the clear need for the involvement of key academic stakeholders who have not been part of discussions to date and the need for them to be included in future planning. And obviously, I'd be happy to expand on that in our Q&A period. Lastly, we articulated concerns about instructional resources related to the program, especially student support services and financial aid that would be essential to help ensure academic success and degree completion for these non-traditional and underserved populations, and also again noted that the proposal really did not fully address those. We encourage, as did the other committees, an initial small-scale pilot to explore these and other potential issues. We also encourage the collection of further information concerning faculty arrangements, especially regarding status of their composition and compensation, and the boundary between faculty duties and independent work from peer institutions that have already launched such programs. So I'll stop there.
Thanks. If there's discussion, comments, questions, raise your digital hand or step up front if you're here. Risa Lieberwitz.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate the thoughtful reports that we've received from the Academic Freedom Committee today, as well as EPC and CAP at the prior meeting. And what I want to do is to raise a serious concern that I have with something that I just saw right before this meeting today. I had not realized until I happened to see it on the Faculty Senate website that the provost had responded to the reports from CAP and EPC on March 3rd. And I really think that this should have been brought to the attention of the Faculty Senate, really highlighting that for discussion today. I'm not saying that the Faculty Senate Committee was responsible for doing that, but it should have been highlighted, because basically what the provost says in his response is that the university is going to move forward with instituting a part-time program, educational program, a degree program. And that to enable that effort, now I'm reading from his words, to enable that effort, I will begin a search for the next dean of the School of Continuing Education and summer sessions, whose primary responsibility will be the establishment of a part-time bachelor's degree program within the school, consistent with the cautions articulated by your committees. Now, I think that the concerns articulated by the committees were so serious that they were more than just, oh, how will we implement this? It was, if we don't address those concerns, we will not have a viable part-time program. So I think this is another example of a unilateral decision being made by the administration, here the provost, without any concern with the Faculty Senate's full deliberation on whether to do such a program, and certainly not even a nod towards the notion of a vote by us. So I'm very, very concerned about this. And this was even prior to the Academic Freedom Committee's report coming out. I hope that we can address this.
Okay. Richard Bensel, if you could take 2 minutes, then we'll have time for one more after you.
Yes. No, the report's very good. I have three questions / points. One has to do with admissions. Last time we were told that admissions would be balanced between those who would pay full freight and those who would be given financial aid, and the program would be self-supporting. I didn't see a reference to the admissions process, which would be two-tier and so forth. The second is, a pilot program doesn't seem to make much sense here. I mean, you know, how can you have a pilot university? I mean, what are you going to have, 5 courses and have people take them, and then you're going to say, give them a degree or not? I mean, I don't see how that works. I'm going to echo Risa. Look, folks, we, in order to have informed discussion, there has to be a consent, and there has to be votes. There has to be a resolution we can amend, that we can talk about. There has to be some action. We're not getting that. That's it.
Courtney Roby.
Yeah, thank you very much. I just want to echo the concerns that Risa raised, particularly in the wording of the provost letter, where he says, we intend to address these concerns through a careful planning process that will be undertaken with the leadership of the School of Continuing Education in summer sessions. So once again, as has happened throughout this process, the Cornell faculty, who are ostensibly, at least among the people who would be designing and offering whatever curricula are deemed appropriate for this part-time BA, are once again nowhere to be found. And the fact that this response came on March 3rd, that it wasn't distributed to faculty, but it's posted behind a couple of links on the Dean of Faculty's website. This is a very frustrating process. I think for me that we've had eloquent and thoughtful responses from CAP, from EPC, from AFPSF, all saying we need to slow down and think more about this. And the response is, we're going to move ahead with it, and you may or may not be consulted at some point in that process.
Thank you. We have time for one more 2 minutes. Laurent Dubreuil.
Thank you. Since I'm discovering the response, if we can call it this way, from the provost, I read that sentence that in part that is interesting to me. Issues of faculty alignment, faculty burden, quality of education, academic standards for students, and so on, were similarly identified by committee members. So he's speaking of the two previous reports, but this one would be the same. But out of the scope of their charge to solve, end of quote. So the idea here is that quality of education, faculty burden, and academic standards are out of the scope of the charge of the committees. Maybe we could discuss endlessly this question, but I believe that there is no doubt that quality of education and academic standards or faculty burden are part of what we, the faculty in the Senate, should discuss. So I would be very unhappy, but I'm often unhappy with the way the central administration proceeds, if I were to be told that this is outside of the requirements and outside of our purview. And I believe we should really, as the faculty, and that our dean of faculty who is representing us, should really insist on us having a very strong voice on quality of education, academic standards for students, through a vote and a careful consideration, not of this kind of vague blueprints and letters slightly hidden on a website, but very careful deliberation based on something that would be tangible.
Thank you. We're now going to move on to a discussion and a presentation of a Cornell Academic Materials Program. From the Cornell Bookstore, Michael Ramsey, James Best, and Shannon Ostick. I'll let them introduce themselves in whatever order they prefer to. So just unmute yourself and begin. 10 minutes.
Hi, everyone. Thank you very much. I'm Jim Best. I'm the assistant director at the Cornell store. A long part of my team is I have Shannon Ostick, who's our marketing and materials, our communications manager. Jane McKellen is also on here, who is our program, our project manager on around this camp program. And then lastly, Michael Ramsey, who is the academic materials manager here in the store, and he will be presenting to you quickly around the Cornell Academic Materials Program. And then I believe we have about 15 minutes to do some quick Q&A. But hopefully, if we run out of time around the Q&A, I'm hoping working with Eve and through the Faculty Senate, we'll have some, we'll share contacts, and so you can send questions, further questions in to us directly. Michael, you want to go ahead?
Thank you. And we'll be doing a screen share. Is that happening? Okay. So Cornell Academic Materials Program, we're looking at an affordable, sustainable course materials delivery program for undergraduates to prioritize student affordability, campus experience, access, and financial sustainability. Next, please. You can go ahead one more. So the task at hand to identify a more sustainable, inclusive, and equitable model for course materials delivery, combat unpredictability of course materials costs and reduce financial barriers, and improve course preparedness. The current ecosystem, as some of you are actually participating in our existing system program, Instant Access, that is based on the course level, which is digital course materials delivery through Canvas. We also have course materials offered at the Cornell store for purchase, various library offerings, reduction in highly expensive print textbooks. We've been working with faculty across the university to come up with alternate options. Transition of course materials to location agnostic. We've seen this quite a bit since the pandemic started. I'll talk more on that in a moment. And expansion of available resources. And I threw what about OER in here? We've been, you know, kind of working across the university to try and build more OER. But at the moment, it's not really on the radar, it seems. So we're trying to work around that. So what we've learned and why we're here. So this, you know, we're really trying this experimental problem. It's not 100% solvable. So we're here today to discuss this with you. Rather than inaction, you know, a call to action. What do we do to move forward? How do we foresee the ecosystem of course materials adapting? And what is our best approach toward affordability and access? So we want to plan for what we're doing now, but we also want to plan for the future. So we're looking at an agile approach. You know, we're here to get feedback. We've met with the student assembly to get feedback. So we're revising the program, get feedback, revise, et cetera, et cetera. So we're seeing three things. Students are using more digital options now than ever before. Students are choosing the most affordable option, which trends dominantly digital. So even in situations where there are variable options, students are choosing the digital option. Print sourcing is becoming more and more unsustainable. We're not saying that print books in general are ever going to go away. I'm sure you've heard that before, and it's not going to happen. But the cycle of course materials is evolving, and so we're just trying to figure out where that moment is. So what digital brings to the college experience? A shift toward more technical literacy. However, we do know that this does not equate to savviness does not equate to literacy. So students have the tablets, they have their phones, they have their computers. They may be part of the digital native generation, but does that mean that they're digitally literate? And so we have to approach this from all sides, both working with CTI on the faculty side, and the tutoring centers and various other places where we can provide guidelines to students on how to use course materials that are digital, how to use anything digital, working with the library to try and come up with those guidelines and best practices. The potential for higher rates of engagement within the course materials and Canvas courses, and just the insights that faculty have available today, and how those can be expanded. Improvement in the financial burden of high cost materials. So we're looking at ways to further bring down the cost, but also to provide device equity. So space for discovery, this is just off of, you know, Cengage is one of the vendors in the college sphere, but also VitalSource, which is one of our digital providers. 70% of students say they would have better grades if they have access to required textbooks and course materials before the first day of class or on the first day of class. And 73% would be interested in paying for course materials as part of tuition. Tuition is not where we're going with this, but having that upfront predictable aspect of this is kind of where we're going. So the current ecosystem evolution, we're targeting for fall of 22 to have all required course materials digital first at perpetual access when available. So there is a little caveat in there where we're really negotiating to try and get perpetual access to course materials as, you know, would with print in most situations, but it depends on what is being used in the course. And this will apply to all undergraduates at the same flat rate, and it'll be at the semester level, not annually. So students will have the ability to decide whether they want to participate in this or not. There will be an opt-out process, if you want to go to the next slide there. So what I mentioned with our Instant Access program, we do have the current opt-out process for students who choose not to participate. So what changes is titles are sourced as digital whenever available. We already do that now, but it is based on the course, individual course level, not across the entire university. Print is included in program scope when digital is not available. So there are and there will be instances where print will be required. One example is lab manuals, but there are other disciplines where digital just does not exist. All courses will have, you know, a Canvas shell enabled, and then it's not required to teach from Canvas. This is just merely an access point for students to get their digital materials. And what stays the same? So the course adoption process stays the same. Faculty submit textbooks and titles, the same process as current, and instruction is available day one. On the sustainability side, so we're looking at a digital-first approach, which brings down the cost of print across the board. And print, like I mentioned, is available only in situations where digital is not. Participation available to all undergrads, available by day one in Canvas. Program costs fully covered for students receiving financial aid, and I'll talk about financial aid a little bit more in a second. Participation based at the semester level, like I mentioned. So if students abroad, they obviously wouldn't be participating. And there are other situations where a student may not participate. Process to decline participation, which would be that opt-out process. Affordability and inclusion. So a campus-wide initiative to tackle this, we're really trying to put a wide net here to bring in the most feedback concerns that we might hear regarding this. We've met with various faculty groups already to try and get that feedback so that we can iterate within the process rather than coming to something like the prior agenda item where you're kind of learning about things at the end. Stabilized semester start experience, predictable lower cost for students. So they will go into the semester knowing what their course, all their required course materials will cost. Predictable distribution, so all undergraduates, they'll have the day one access in Canvas. For physical items, they will pick those up. And lower program costs allows for a rebalance of financial aid. It's not a reduction. So currently the way that financial aid factors in the cost of books and supplies can be a bit of a large bucket. And so we're trying to narrow down those costs as much as possible so that they can be attributed to the proper place. Accessibility, so Canvas-centric universal application across all disciplines. Like I mentioned, there are other departments that utilize various other LMS. So this is merely just an access point for the digital materials. Continuous accessibility. So we're working with various components on campus, as well as our vendors to make sure that we have content and platform accessibility, web compliance standards, student data security, taking a universal design approach, alternative formats and existing process for accommodation. So just expansion of that and expansion to technology resources. So later phases or as we work through this to try and figure out where those devices fit in and how students will get those devices needed for digital. Faculty equity side, so preserving academic freedom. Whatever is required is what you're submitting. So we're working with that. Promote student preparedness, like I said, day one. Potential for increased student engagement. There are insights, analytics, and reporting that are available to courses that participate in our Instant Access program today. And there are various other methods of insight which are available to faculty through Canvas, et cetera. We have the annotation feature with Hypothesis. We have assessment with CoachMe. and auto-enabled day one. So no more setup for books. So if you do participate in our current instant access program where you have to toggle on and off the tools, those will be auto-enabled moving forward. This is just a quick look at the instructor analytics for a course with this book, Give Me Liberty. Review student activity. It brings up student usage of the book. So we can see that 40% of the students haven't accessed the book. And the average time or average session length is 15 minutes. So this is, you know, spreading it out where students are engaging, where they aren't. Next slide, please. And it breaks down into four quartiles to see the students that are engaged the most and the students that are engaged the least. So we have the fourth quartile where they're spending 9 hours total time, 55 minutes per session, 205 pages. We have sessions. We have average session length. We have annotations. You can see some students are making well over 200 annotations in the text, how many times they're going in and out of the text and the materials. So you can see where the engagement is coming from. And next slide, please. And this is Hypothesis. Hypothesis is a separate vendor, which is already enabled in Canvas. Hypothesis allows for annotation within any types of written materials. So it can even be websites, it can be ebooks, it can be anything at this point. And so if this is something that you are interested in as well, we are working and looking for courses who would like to test out the Hypothesis annotation. And this is just examples of different formats of text where it's available. It can be public websites. It can be anything from older digital items to newer digital items. And then CoachMe is a feature that we just unrolled with our partner VitalSource. It is AI-driven assessment questions that automatically come up within the text so students can self-test. This is on the right-hand side, you see just a list of courses that we kind of rolled this out to. This is a screenshot of what it actually looks like in one of the tests. All right, next slide, thank you. So sources, best practices, and resources, these are just some of the places that we've also externally garnered feedback and are really driving our process forward. And I think we can skip all the way to the last slide.
Okay, I see one hand up in Zoom. If you have, if you'd like to speak in person, step up to the microphone. Courtney Roby.
Yeah, thank you very much for the presentation and for the work that you're doing attempting to reduce the cost of textbooks for students, which I understand is a problem. I will say, as a humanities professor whose undergraduate degree is in engineering, I'm aware of the vast differences in expense for course materials in, say, humanities and a lot of STEM disciplines. So one concern that I have is that extracting a fee from every student at Cornell up front means that students in some disciplines are invariably going to be subsidizing students in others. My second concern, I have certainly attempted to make use of the Instant Access program.
Mm-hmm. Lisa.
Technically, it works very well. However, I frequently find that the materials that I think are best for my students are not included. So presumably, this program, if it works like an expansion of Instant Access, the pool of materials available for free to students is publisher-driven, not driven by us as faculty. And so that, I think, becomes an issue of pedagogical control. While I do understand that there's an opt-out option, which is great. And while I do understand that faculty don't have to use these materials, nevertheless, my primitive understanding of behavioral economics suggests that students will not necessarily rationally be able to opt out or know when or how or that they can. And that there's also going to be tremendous pressure on faculty to choose the materials that happen to be in this pool because of the perception of sunk costs. Those are just some concerns about the program that I wanted to voice. I did see at the beginning that you did mention the possibility of OER being perhaps a better solution to these problems, and I couldn't agree more. And frankly, I think that the way that Cornell could best support a transition to more affordable teaching materials would be to meaningfully support and incentivize the creation of OER by our faculty to teach our classes. So thank you very much.
Thank you. We have an in-person speaker. Introduce yourself and identify your department.
Ken Berman, Computer Science. Michael and Jim, thank you very much for the presentation. It's very interesting. I actually have a question. I was wondering if you've studied the cost of materials for students across the campus, and if you have any kind of a breakdown of the disparities in cost associated with different programs we run and different styles of study. I think your emphasis on affordability is excellent, but I don't have a good feeling for a good grounding on where we're starting and where you believe we're going to end up. And actual numbers would be very helpful.
Sure. I think we are simply just completely across the board with disciplines. We have our really high-end disciplines that can cost upwards of $1,000 annually. And then we have our lower humanities disciplines, which could, cost students anywhere between $200-$300 annually. So we're really looking to kind of fit in the middle somewhere where we impact the most students. And as mentioned in the prior comment, there will be students that this model just simply won't make sense because they don't have those costs already. And we would expect those students to basically not participate in the model. And I think that one of our long-term goals is to, once again, decrease the cost continuously. By working through those other different types of initiatives, whether it's OER or it's whether working with faculty and the publishers to try and come up with more reasonable solutions. The next iteration of this, we're not sure. And so just moving that forward a little and trying to identify, because we're living in it now, so we're not only trying to resolve this issue currently, but we're also trying to plan for the future. Right. So the general goal is to make sure that the program is well priced, and that we may have to adjust that to continuously make sure it is well priced for the future.
That's a good answer, Michael. I appreciate it. But the dean of the faculty does have a way to host additional materials on her website, and if it would be possible to share with us some of those financial projections. And as I said, baseline where we are today and how it breaks down and what different students are experiencing, because it sounds like you have those numbers, and then projections for where this will take us, I think that would really be very helpful for the discussion. And after all, if the purpose of bringing this to the Senate is to get Senate advice and recommendations, we need to work from that kind of concrete metric-based basis.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Yep. And we do have some student breakouts that we can kind of share those.
Okay, back to Zoom. Jonathan Russell and Ellie.
Yeah, Michael, thank you very much. This is a timely topic, and I'm actually fairly supportive of where you're going. And I would also like to say I'm seconding, thirding, and fourthing probably what Courtney said, so I don't really want to reiterate what she said. I just have one comment, question, observation then, and it's this is more from a position of coming as a student rather than as a faculty member. I would like to know why you guys went for the opt-out option rather than the opt-in option. There's certainly an optics issue there, but the difference isn't all that much from a front-end loading perspective from both you guys as well as the students, but it's a huge difference for students that somehow miss it or whatever. And I think perhaps maybe you should think about switching that dynamic. And let's just listen to what you have to say for that. Thanks.
Sure. So I'll tackle that. We have tried the pilot as opt-in, and quite frankly, it just didn't work because that is basically how it's done now. As students are opting into purchasing books through the Cornell store through Amazon, and the program was not sustainable in that sense. The second was that we are fronting the costs of these course materials for students to use for the 3 weeks. And then once they decide whether to opt in or opt out, that is when we are reimbursed for those course materials. So if they decide to opt out, and we don't charge them. If they stay in the program, then that's when we charge those students. So we do work within a timeline, per se, where we do provide those course materials free of charge so that they can just focus on going to class and not worrying about procuring their course materials. And then after they've had time to both use the course materials and price compare with other options, that's when we would get reimbursed for those through the Bursar billing.
We have a question, comment.
Can I follow that up? This is Jonathan Russell-Nelly. Can I follow that up?
Quickly.
Yeah. So, Michael, I understand where you're coming from on that, but that first part of it, I'm not really buying that as an argument because it's really just how after 3 weeks, you know, things disappear and suddenly students will opt in rather than, oh, it's still there. I totally forgot about opting out. But yeah, I think, again, I'm very supportive of this. Thank you.
In-person comment?
David Delsham, Electrical and Computer Engineering. Whoops, feedback. I was in one of the faculty groups that Jim met with over Zoom on this at some point. I forget exactly where it was, but it's because of my job, EPC chair. I asked the same kind of opt-in, opt-out question that was just asked. And I also had some questions about students' feelings about things that I didn't know their feelings about. Okay, so for example, you know, Courtney raised this subsidy thing that say the art students are going to be subsidizing the engineering students because of vast differences between costs, and that maybe not all students are rational actors that way. I'm thinking in terms of students who are rational actors in the following sense, that they would, if they had the option, they would do this for some courses and not for other courses. They would split it between courses like they can now with instant access. This program, they have to opt in or opt out for all courses at once. They're either part of it or they're not. And I'm just curious about whether any of the student focus groups said, we wish we could do this course by course rather than whole program. Okay, that's one question I had. Another question I had was about the perpetual access thing. Like, if I were designing this program, I would, instead of having the perpetual access quantifier be after the, if digital, when digital is available, we're going digital, I would have it before. I would say that we will go digital if perpetual access digital is available. And if not, we will offer a perpetual access other option. And I'm curious about whether students raised that issue or whether you thought about that. That's all I have to say.
And thank you for that. As far as the student focus groups, we have not heard anything regarding the difference between IA and this program in terms of they would prefer to do it on the individual course level or not. And regarding perpetual access, the perpetual access has mostly come from the faculty side and not from the student side.
Okay, we're going to have to move on. I think there's a couple of people who want to speak. I encourage you to place comments on the Faculty Senate or Dean of Faculty website or in the chat. We have to move on to a proposal presentation, Inclusion and Prioritization of a New Nanatorium in the Do the Greatest Good Capital Campaign. We have Senators Ashley Newman and Mary Katzenstein who are here. So please begin. You have 5 minutes.
Thank you very much. So I just want to start off, are we on the slide? Yes. Thanking and acknowledging the additional senators who reached out after last month's meeting to co-sponsor the resolution. Next slide. And also thank Mary, who agreed to speak today, and I will let her do so now, and then I'll resume.
Thanks, Ashley. I'll try to be quick because I feel I should cede time to Wendy and Abby because I know the comments are going to be important. So at the suggestion of Ken Tuppel, who's Professor Emeritus in Architecture and former Dean of Students, CAPE, which is the Association of Professors Emerita, circulated the Navigatorium resolution to its membership. We did this knowing that a number of professors emeriti utilize the pools for health and fitness reasons. So we asked for commentary, and we received a good number of replies that strongly supported the proposal. Some of the comments are encapsulated in this slide, but to summarize the summary, respondents noticed that the facilities have long been out of date since the 1950s when they were very timely and in good form. Now, for the last decades, they have been seriously out of date. That the competition for time is intense given the limitations of the pool's current conditions. Some emeriti have gone elsewhere to the Y, Island Fitness, Borg Warner because of the Cornell pool conditions. And finally, that the only way new facilities will be built, one person commented, I think quite insightfully, is if the university sets this as a priority, given that the varsity alumni of swimming are not likely to be able to provide the necessary funding. So overall, there was very strong interest in seeing new facilities made a priority in the campaign. Ashley, back to you.
Thanks so much, Mary. So I just wanted to highlight two minor amendments that were made to the resolution since last month. And the first one is really an acknowledgement that participation in physical, cultural, and social activities outside of one's primary studies or work provides individuals with a sense of belonging at Cornell and enriches their overall well-being. So we acknowledge the importance of all of these areas. The reason this resolution was focused on one such issue, the pool, was mainly because of the knowledge surrounding the issue and personal involvement that myself and Senator Yuval Grossman had, as well as the dire need and really the ticking time clock that is on these facilities. The other amendment was in response to the discussion that the swim test graduation requirement may in fact be going away. So the wording was changed so that this can stand regardless of the decision, so that over 100 years this graduation requirement has been in place. And I wanted to also amend something that was incorrect in the last version. The first version had that you had to swim 75 yards in order to pass the test and graduate. That is not in fact true. You can certainly do that. But if you do not, you enroll in 2 semesters of beginning swimming. And then even if during those 2 semesters, you don't complete that 3 laps of the pool, as long as you participate, you pass those classes, you graduate. So the language here is amended to accurately reflect that requirement. Next slide. And I wanted to just provide updates to the Faculty Senate that this has really become a campus-wide initiative, and it's been really great to see the interest beyond myself and other faculty extended to professors emeriti, as Mary highlighted. And I spoke on February 22nd at the University Assembly in response to the UA Resolution Number 5, support for our Faculty Senate proposed resolution. I was invited by Deborah Howell, who is the chair of the Campus Welfare Committee. And I will also be speaking tomorrow at the Student Assembly because they've expressed interest in this as well. So that's where things stand now. And I'll just put a plug in. Based on that earlier slide that Nima had, that voting opens tomorrow at 9 a.m. and will be open for 2 weeks. So I am putting forth a plea to please vote. If you have any questions about the resolution, please contact me. One feedback I have received is the confusion or perhaps the dislike of the term natatorium. In no way is this resolution proposing a name. Honestly, the university can call this thing whatever they want. If they will throw their support behind this. Natatorium was used in the title simply because it is the name of a building with a swimming pool. So I apologize if people had to Google that word, but like I said, call it whatever you want. That's just for the sake of naming. Thank you so much.
We have time for 3. Good of the order. Please try to do 1.5 minutes. I'll cut you off after 2 minutes. The order will be... David Lee, then Richard Bensel, then Risa Lieberwitz. So David Lee, I assume you're online.
Yes, I'm online. I hope you can hear me okay. David Lee, Dyson School. I was one of the faculty members that was on the part-time committee, the ad hoc committee that the provost set up last spring. And I just, in partial defense that we weren't completely irresponsible, which is sort of the tenor of the discussion somehow, I just wanted to remind everyone that we, in our 22-page report, in which we identified most, perhaps not all, but virtually all of the issues that have come up in the last couple, two or three meetings, we specifically said, we recommended that a phase two implementation committee be created and that it look into the following issues. I'm just going to briefly read them. Organizational structure and leadership, degree name, associated NICED requirements, specific admissions criteria, specific majors and concentrations, faculty workload and compensation, including appropriate mix of tenure-track faculty, academic and career advising, tuition model, price point, availability of financial aid, is there a cannibalizing of the regular Cornell in-person program, articulation agreements and transfer credit policies. And we ended with the last sentence was, the process for engaging the Faculty Senate should be robust, allowing review of the committee report, discussion, and critical feedback. So I just wanted to remind everyone that, there has been a lot of attention to these matters already. And one of the explicit recommendations of the committee was that a further step be pursued to address many of these issues.
Thank you. Richard Bensel, 2 minutes.
Yes, thank you, Jonathan. Just 2 points. One is when Vice President Barner was discussing the organization and procedures of the university faculty, I asked her whether Section 2, which is one that she was citing in her summary of the resolution, whether her office was mentioned. Section 2 is less than half a page long, and she said she didn't know. And that's disappointing. I mean, that's the first, if she's going to cite it, that's the first place you would look. The second thing is that it has been 6 months, and today as well, we have not had an opinion from Vice President Barner. The third thing is that she has no standing to offer a definitive opinion to the Faculty Senate because she has mentioned, her office is mentioned nowhere in the organization and procedures of the university faculty. What that means is that the reference of the resolution 6 months ago to Vice President Barner, anyone can do this, that's a personal opinion. But for the UFC to prevent that resolution from coming before this body for 6 months for a personal opinion that has no standing under our regulations is wrong. I'm done.
Risa Lieberwitz, 2 minutes.
Yeah, thank you. Risa Lieberwitz, ILR. So I put in the chat that I propose that we have a Senate meeting on March 23rd. Which is the date reserved in the list of Senate meetings for an additional meeting as needed. And I think we clearly need it for the sort of robust deliberation that David Lee pointed to. I'm glad that you reminded us, David, that you put that in the report. We have not had really any deliberation by the Senate based on the initial report and then these three Senate committee reports that we've heard. The provost put out a letter basically saying he's made a decision, we're moving forward, and that the faculty really is not within the faculty's purview to address some of the issues that Laurent noted in his letter. But we have not deliberated, and I think that for respect for our Senate committees, we should have a full deliberation about this, not 5 minutes, 10 minutes. I mean, that's not deliberation. That's just sort of get your comments in if you can manage to get your hand up quickly enough. So I propose that we have this meeting on March 23rd and that we devote it either completely or primarily to discussing this very important question of whether to move forward on the part-time degree program, and that we also discuss the what I consider a real affront to faculty governance and our three committee reports that we heard, and a real disrespect for our ability as a Senate to deliberate and vote on whether to move forward on this program and whether this is the right time, all of those kinds of connected questions. Thank you.
Thank you. It's 5 o'clock. By rules, faculty Senate meeting is adjourned.